Our speaker this afternoon for this birthday program, I met about 6 years ago, and ever since then he has been a constant example to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had a lot of fun with him. He's one of the people in AA that, to me, puts a lot of punch in this part of the program to make it fun. We've often playfully referred to Manny as Father OB, which is a joke going way back that you'd have to be more familiar with to appreciate it. But at the same time, in being an example, I know from watching him and being with him in the program that he is a real good, serious AA that lives this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the best examples I can cite of that is that when Clarence was having his trouble traveling around over the Southeastern Territory, I gave him a list of men to contact when he got into the various cities where he stayed at night that could help him with his AA program. And Manny was one of them. And the fact that of all these people that I gave Clarence a list of, that he should select Manny to speak on his birthday, I think, is example enough. Manny is from Eastover, South Carolina. And if any of you don't know where Eastover is, Columbia and Sumter are suburbs of Eastover. So now, Manny.
Hello, everyone. You know, don't you want to come back and say some more about me? This was good, you know. I'm telling you, this boy's on the ball. No wonder he got elected your president of Georgia. That's what he is, isn't he? If you don't watch him, he's going to be vice president, secretary, and treasurer, commander-in-chief. What did I say to you over the phone today? That was it. Well, if he needs any help, I'll come down here and help him, and y'all run me back to South Carolina. My name is Manuel Berger, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I have never been to this group, but I've heard a lot about it because, you see, we sent you a fellow down here to Georgia, up here to Georgia, that helped start this group. Didn't Russ help start this group?
Second
group. He did? Well, you see, Russ is one of our boys, and you got something to look forward to. Russ asked me about 4 weeks ago, he was down in Sumter, South Carolina, he told me the names of the speakers he wanted, and he told me, I don't want you to say anything, and that was nice. And he told me, but I want you to come. And he told me who to bring. They'll bring us, if I can get off, but he's going to have three speakers from Columbia. And these three are men that helped him when he came into AA. And I think you're in for a treat. That's 14th. I'll advertise it a little bit. That's the 14th of November, 3 o'clock, in this building. Right? Good. So much for promotion. I am an alcoholic. And I didn't know this until after I'd gotten into AA. I knew I was something, but I didn't know what it was. I'd been told what it was a lot of times. Didn't like it. And sometimes I told them off. And sometimes they told me off. And that's the way it works when you don't do what you're supposed to do that they think. I don't know why I became an alcoholic, and then sometimes I think I do too. But I don't let it bother me. You know, I know a number of people, perhaps not too many, but they worry about why they are alcoholics. What made them an alcoholic? How come they had to stoop so low to join AA? You see, that's what's really the trouble. And most of these people that continue to worry about why they are alcoholics, they have to worry again, because usually they get drunk and have to start over again. And this is true. I was a mixed-up kid, and now I'm a mixed-up man. And this is true. It's no use for me to lie about it. People that know me know that I'm a confused sort of individual. I got lost here in Atlanta. People told me the right way to go, but I had to go the wrong way. But I found myself. But I was this way as a kid, I think. I resented a lot of things and a lot of people when I was a child. I was raised in a small town, South Carolina, about 30 miles from Columbia, called St. Matthews. I wanted to be something I wasn't and couldn't. I wanted to do things I couldn't or didn't, and I didn't like it. And I'm sure in my inner self, there was a good beginning of becoming an alcoholic. I'm not saying that I was born an alcoholic. I don't believe anyone is. This is my opinion. But I believe that it's easy to become one in early childhood. And it shows up when you start gulping the booze. I can remember my first drunk. When I did drink, I said, "This is what I need. This is what I want." It gave me this kind of a feeling that I can do anything I want to do and I can be anyone I want to be. And then I remember, the next drunk, you might say, and the sick drunk in Columbia at the university. I wanted to drink at parties of this and that and other. And I got drunk this time, and I became sick. And I mean sick. When the world, it seems, is moving around faster than I could see. And after this one and on this one, I think I prayed, if it's such a thing as calling it that. And I said, if I get over this, I'll never do it again, long as I live. And I got over it. And I said I wasn't going to do it again. About 3 weeks later, I went to a dance at the Jefferson Hotel, and I didn't know how to dance unless I drank. And I got on another drink. I never did get sick, is this again, for at least a year or two. But then alcohol became the thing that I needed, whether I was happy or whether I was sad, or whether somebody made me mad or whether somebody made me happy. It didn't make, or whatever I was going to do, go to a ball game, or go here, or go there. It seemed that alcohol became a part of my life, and it did. And as the years went by, I indulged more and more and more. And now I understand why people before me and now say, this is a progressive disease. And I have watched so many people that didn't quit and haven't quit, how progressive this thing called alcoholism can be. And I believe it was. I didn't get into too much trouble in the beginning because, I don't know, I got by with it. You know, I lost something as time went on. It's a funny thing, we all lose it. And that's you. And that's the dickens. Yeah? But we lose it. And as time goes on, things become worse. I became a traveling salesman, and that didn't help it any. About, I guess, when I was about 27 years old, I'm guessing, I decided I ought to get married. Maybe that would be the cure. I was looking for a cure at that time. And I remember meeting a young lady in Columbia, and we started going out together. And not too long afterwards, I said to her one night, I think I'm going to get married. And she wanted to know who I was going to marry. And I told her. And she said, not me. And that hurt me. I didn't like to lose. We don't like to lose, do we? And I said, why? And she says, you drink all the time. Every time you've been to see me, you are drinking, and many times too much. And I said, I can quit any time I want. I can take it or leave it alone. Look at me out on the road, lonesome, living in hotels, eating in restaurants. You drink too. I can take it or leave it alone. If you marry me, I'll never do it again. And she married me. The shrewd, slick alcoholic. And by golly, I didn't drink at home for at least a month, but I drank on the road. And then one day I had to stagger in, like most drunks will do. And then she got mad. And then I got mad. And then I says, I'll show you how to drink now. And it gave me the excuse, and I was off to the races. You know, I didn't want to do this even then. I knew that alcohol was a problem with me. And I didn't want this problem. And yet, there seemed no way out. And I continued to drink, and I was a psychologist at that time. I'm not now, thank God. Because I didn't go to school for it, and I didn't have the background. But one day I said to my wife and her mother, and I think that's a nice group to get together when you're going to do things, I said, I think the reason that I drink too much is because I'm a traveling salesman. If I was settled down, I don't believe I'd drink. And my mother-in-law, bless her heart, says, son, I believe you're right. You want to go in business, don't you? I said, yes. And she says, I'll help you. And that's what I was waiting on. And I went down to the lower part of South Carolina and went in business. Down around the Santee Cooper area. Many of you have been down there fishing, perhaps. And things were good. Just a little bit before the war started. And that was bad. And, you know, it's a funny thing. When things get too good, that can be dangerous for some people. And I was one of these. So you start off your drinking, you know, on a Thursday afternoon when you close your business. And then as time goes on, it becomes Friday and then later Saturday and Sunday. And pretty soon it's 2 weeks and 3 weeks and whatever it is. And when you happen to be your own boss, you figure who's going to fire you. And that's bad because nobody there to fire you. Now, your wife is raising the devil about this time. And she tells me so. But this I didn't want to do either. And yet, every time I get on these drunks, I would say, you're wrong. You shouldn't do it. And I knew it. I didn't want to do it. And yet somehow, I don't know, the urge had become so great that when I did take the first drink, as I learned later in AA, this is the one that started me. And when I got on it, I hated to get off of it because I had to suffer. And no one likes to suffer. And that's the reason I stayed on them a little longer, I guess. As time went on, my wife threatened to leave me. That's a normal procedure, I think, in most families. And I said, she's not going to leave me. I'm a good husband, and I'm a good father. And now we've got two little boys, and she can't do without me. Then there was a fellow working for me about this time that used to tell me when I would get off of a drunk. He would say, gee, you've been sober about two or three days. He says, that's wonderful. And I said, yeah, still suffering. And he would say, any man that can stay sober for one or two days can stay sober forever. Didn't he talk AA? He didn't know he was doing it because he never drank in his life. And, you know, it made sense. And I can remember this man walking off, we'd both walk off, and he would say to me, "You're not hurting anyone but yourself." And I'd say, "That's right, that's right." And when he walked off a little more and I walked off a little more, I knew better. I knew that that was a lie. Any man or woman that drinks hurts everything around them, and including themselves. And I knew this. As time went on, I can remember many nights going to bed, whether it was 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, saying with tears in my eyes and running down my cheeks, "Get off of this drunk. You've got to suffer it out. You can't taper off. Don't take the drink when you get up." And I wanted to do this so badly. And yet, when I did awaken, whatever time it was, I started to look for the bottle. I needed this bottle. And my wife was the kind that poured it out, and that doesn't help anything. And I used to be the kind that many times I would hide it so well that I couldn't find it when I looked for it. And it could be early in the morning after 2 hours, you know. Where do you go to a bootlegger? Everybody has a favorite bootlegger. You usually pay your bootlegger better than you do your groceries. Well, that's all you're interested in anyway. I was a little lucky at that time and still had 15 or 20 cents running around. I used to drive out to this bootlegger's. I can remember on a few occasions, not many, that I couldn't drive to this house where he lived, because these were all dirt roads and clay and mud, and I would have to park the car and get out and take my shoes and socks off and walk 2 miles to his house and knock on the side of his house and tell him, "I've got to have a drink." And this I seemed to, it was a must. And he'd bring it out, and I'd stand by his well to get a couple down, and then walk back to the car 2 miles and put the shoes and socks back on and roll the pants down and get in the car and come back to this little town where I lived. The liquor stores were open, and I'd open up the business and began to drink until the help got in. And this was over and over again when I was on a drunk. You know, we talk about insanity in AA, and we say in this step, "I'm frightened. Look, I am sane. I've never been crazy, and how can you tell me that I've ever been insane? What is this if it's not insanity?" Have you ever seen any man or woman drunk that were really sane? This I found out later on. About this time, the wife said, "I don't care if you've got a $1 million business. I'm leaving you." And you know, I began to believe her. I'm going home to Mama. So I got on a little drunk, if it's such a thing as a little drunk. And I said, "Don't do it, honey. I'll sell out and go with you. Big hero." And she said, "That's fine." She says, "I believe the reason you drink so much is because you associate with the wrong kind of people." And I said, "You're right. That's the trouble." "Hell, that wasn't the trouble. You know it, and I know it. But that's just as good an excuse as any." So I got drunk enough to sell out. And she left and went home to Mama with the children, waiting on me to come up to her mother's home, and we would start life anew, the good little boy. Isn't that what they call us once in a while? The good little boy. And after she left and sobered up a little bit to realize what I'd done, then I really pitched a good one, and she wasn't around to criticize me. About 2 or 3 weeks later, to close out this business, the war had been on me. Oh, a couple of years. And I got a letter. And the letter read, "To report to Fort Jackson on so-and-so a day." And I looked at this thing, and I kept looking at it. through bloodshot eyes, and I said, "Dern her." And I went to the telephone, and I called up my wife. And I let her have it with both barrels. This was a dirty trick to put me in the army to get rid of me. And I didn't like it. And she said she had nothing to do with it. But I don't remember what I told her, but you can bet it wasn't too nice, don't you think so? I don't remember either. So I said, "I'll go because I've got to," but I didn't like it. But not this way. I'd go myself, but not her. It was a few days later that a fella came by and he said, "Berger, have you heard anything from Fort Jackson?" I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Oh, it was a couple of weeks ago, right after your wife left. You were drunk as a cooter. And you asked me to drive you to Columbia, and I did, and you staggered into the draft board, and I'm behind you. And you walked in there and told him that you were a fighting son of a gun. You wanted to join the army." Now, why I bring this out, what did I do? What would you do? I was wrong, you see. But I'm not going to admit it. I didn't run to the telephone and say, "Honey, I was wrong." I never told her I was wrong. I was always right. If you said it was day and I wanted it that way, it was night. I didn't want to be wrong. I always wanted to be right. Because I knew I wasn't right. You see, we people know when we do wrong. I don't believe, but it's a very small percentage of alcoholics, if we wish, that don't know they're doing wrong when they're drunk, unless they had a blackout. But I used to know I was doing wrong, but I didn't give a doggone. That was the main reason. I left, went up to her mother's, and we had a wonderful 4 weeks. I stayed sober, and that was a miracle. And I took off for Uncle Sam's army, and I knew it wouldn't last too long when I got in there. And I didn't get drunk until I got in, before I got in that night in Columbia. And I stayed that way for the next few years. You can't get it. That's a good place for me to go. And I stayed drunk. Oh, they didn't like me too well, especially my commanding officers. They wondered how they ever let me into service. And he never did put me in the brig, but he wanted to. But I always said, "Yes, sir, and no, sir." You know, I didn't get into too many jails. You know why? I said, "Yes, sir, and no, sir." Right here in Atlanta, too. They don't like to do you that way when you try to be kind to these poor officers, whether they are police officers or army officers. I ended up in the nut house in the service for a little while. But that was not too bad. I got out of there a few years later as a buck sergeant. I haven't figured that out yet either. I stayed out in California because I remembered reading about the 49ers. And I was going to do the same thing. I was going to become a millionaire out there. Had my wife and children out there. I went in business out there. I'll never forget, there was a lieutenant got out the same time I did, and we lived in the same section, and his name was Duncan McCorkindale. He had been born in Scotland, and old Duncan had lived in Detroit most of his life, and we got out at the same time, and I said, "Duncan, let's look around for a place, a business, and we'll go in together." And we looked all over Oakland, California, and we found one. He said we found one. He says, "This is electrical appliances and all this stuff." And he says, "I know all about it. I'm from Detroit." We were both tight then. And I said, "If you know all about it, we'll buy it. And I'll pay for it now because my mother-in-law had some money holding for me, unfortunately. And you give me the money back when you borrow that $10,000 on GI. I've never met one yet that ever borrowed that $10,000. I don't remember. Anyway, we bought it. And I said then and there, we can't lose. There is Duncan McCorkindale, a Scotchman, and here I am, born of the Jewish faith. How in the hell you going to lose? Can't do it. I want to tell you something. We lost. I stayed at Joe's Corner. And I told them all about South Carolina and these southern people. And I let them have it. They didn't pay any attention to me, but I told them about it. I didn't stay in the store, but Duncan got mad because he couldn't get out, and he told me he was leaving. He and his wife made up again, and they were leaving for Detroit. Then I closed her up. We laugh in AA. We learn to laugh. We don't come in laughing. We come in sad. Many of us come in without a family. Many of us come in with a family but without a job. Many of us come in about to lose the family and the job. Sometimes a wife comes along with very little faith in her husband or vice versa and said, let's try it anyway. It can't hurt him. I've seen it. And I know that they weren't laughing. I didn't come in laughing. And yet, I've seen many men and women come into AA, and just a few months later, I see these same people laughing. We have learned to laugh at ourselves and with others and not at others, because if we do, we are not too good an AA, in my opinion. But with others. You can't buy this kind of medicine in a drugstore. They can't give it to you in any hospital as great as Atlanta hospitals are, or any doctor, how big or how little, in the city of Atlanta or any other city. But here in AA, we have learned, those of us that have tried, have learned to laugh at ourselves and with us. Wonderful medicine, not bottled and not in pill form, but here with each other, with brotherly love. This is the kind of medicine, thank God, I found. But there wasn't any laughing in California because I didn't go home a lot of nights. I wasn't a homebody drunk. I was a traveling drunk. And when I went away, there was this wife and two little boys, 3 and 5, I think, at that time. They didn't have a father, because he would wake up many mornings and look around. And as low as I had gotten, I was even ashamed to see what was there and slip away to get another drink so I would forget. And then sooner or later go home. And the wife would say, my oldest son's name is Arthur. Arthur would ask, where's his father? And I'd tell him, I don't know. And I thought she used to say this so she could hurt my feelings. Can you imagine that? This is the kind of a person that anyone in reason can become if you drink long enough and strong enough. And I was drinking long enough, and God knows I surely drank long enough. And I remember it wasn't long after this that I said, we better go home, or else we won't get back to South Carolina. And she agreed. We'd bought a home. We sold it. And I remember the night before we left, I'd been sober a few days, and I helped pack the car, the suitcases, ship the rest. And I remember the morning that we were leaving for South Carolina, I said, I've got a little bit of business downtown in Oakland. I said, I won't be gone but just a few minutes. And that was my intentions. And I got down there and I met a few people saying Berger or similar to this. I don't remember the words. But I guess they said, we hate to see you go. This was some of my drinking buddies. Let's take a little drink for the road. And I did. And I took another and another and another and another. And I don't remember what time it was. But there she drove up in front of this building, she knew where I was, with a neighbor driving the car and two little kids and a collie puppy. Yes, I was tight, but I could see it. Maybe close one eye, but I saw them. And behind this car, another carload. And I always will believe there was another carload of neighbors behind that one. And I know what they said. And you know what they said. Probably said, what's going to happen to this wife, these two little children, with this no good drunk? They didn't want any part of me. And I can understand now. Now, remember, she was a Southpaw. And she said, drunk or sober, get in the car and let's go home. 3,000 miles away. And I got in the car and we started out with a drunk driver. We made it. I drank a little bit on the first day, a sip a little bit. She gave me this privilege, if you want to call it that, and I slipped a few too. And about 7 days later, we drove up to a little town in South Carolina called Abbeville, my wife's mother's home. And I walked in and brought the baggage in and greeted my dear mother-in-law. And after we'd been there a little while, I said to her, I'm through with booze. And she said, thank God. She says, you really mean it? I said, I never meant anything more in my life, and I meant it. And I told them all, I got a sister that lives in a town about 15 miles away. And I got in that car and drove down to my sister's and her husband. I says, I have quit drinking for good. Never again I'll touch it. I drove down into Columbia and met a few more people. I says, I'm through drinking. And I did this all in the lower part of the state. People I hadn't seen in years. Some of them probably didn't know I was that bad of a drunk. To tell them I'd quit drinking. Figure that one out. I can't. I don't know why. I still don't know why. I went down there and I got drunk down there before I got back. Yeah. But I sobered up enough to get back. But my brother-in-law didn't know it. And he said, you really quit drinking? I said, yeah. He says, let's go in business down the lower part of the state. I said, that's the man. I'm your man. That's what I wanted to do, I guess. And we ended up in a town called Walterboro, South Carolina, down close to Charleston. And I remember this brother. Oh, I remember we bought it from a fella that I knew a number of years. And I remember him turning to my brother-in-law and says, you know that this brother-in-law of yours drinks pretty heavy. In fact, too much. That dirty rat, I wanted to kill him, but I couldn't open my mouth. If I'd been by myself, I probably would have had something to say about it. Or more. And my brother-in-law says, don't worry about him anymore. He promised me he'd never touch it again. Isn't that wonderful how much faith they had in me? And he left me a couple of days later. It was a long building, about the size of this, a little longer, except on the back. It was a little place cut out on a side street. Guess what it was? A liquor store! And I worked for a day or so, and I got lonesome. My wife was with Mama. And I went out the back door into the liquor store to get company. You know, we alcoholics get pretty doggone lonesome, don't we? And we need company. And the only company we know is alcohol. And that's what I did. The normal procedure that it became a habit pattern over the years. And I drank two or three days and passed out. Like, yeah, what you do? And then woke up and said, I know my trouble. Go get your wife and children. And that's what I did. Drunk. And got up to my mother-in-law's home. She met me at the door, raising the devil because I'd never do it again. And that's when I found out what made me a drunk. And that's what I told her. You are the reason I'm a drunk. You tell me what to do. You tell my wife what to do. You tell the children when they should even go to the bathroom. That's the reason I'm a drunk. You. And she started crying, and my wife started crying, and I said, let's get out of here. Do you know she went with me? We got the children and off to this town where a new town she'd never lived before. And we went into this town. And my brother-in-law in Greenwood said, one more drunk, you out, buddy. I says, it won't happen anymore. Don't worry about it. I just got too lonesome, I guess, without my dear little wife and children. And I didn't drink again for at least a month. And I'm not going into any more drunks, but I want to remember this one. I'd gotten a letter from a fella I didn't know a week before that. And it said, why don't you try AA? And boy, did I burn. I tore that letter up. I didn't want to know about AA, and that was a dirty trick. How did he find out to write me? Somebody must have been talking and telling him I drank too much. Can you imagine that? And I remember a year or so previous, Out in Oakland, California, one night, my wife said to me, "They're having a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you go?" I says, "Not me. I can take it or leave it alone. I don't want to be mixed up with a bunch of bums." And this was probably the view of many people that drank too much. I says, "I don't want them feeling sorry for me, and I don't want to feel sorry for them." And that's the next time I heard of AA. But there this Sunday morning on the floor about like this, I had passed out, and something was shaking me, and I looked up, and there was my father, who had never seen me in this condition before. Drunk, yes, but not in this condition. And my wife's brother, who was a medical student, his last year at the medical college in Charleston, South Carolina. And he asked me what was wrong, and I told him. I'd been telling people a long time about it. I was sick. That's what was wrong with me. And I was sick. And when you were drunk, you were sick too. You can bet on that. And they said, "Let's go home." And I did, but as I said, I didn't like to go home when I was drinking too much. It was 2 days later, this brother-in-law came to see me, and he called me aside, and he said, "I know what's wrong with you." I says, "Tell me." He says, "You are an alcoholic." I says, "How do you know?" He says, "I've been worried about you. I knew you drank too much for years, but I drink too. So I didn't want to tell anyone else how to operate. But I've been talking to a lot of the doctors at the college. I've been talking to other people. I've even been talking to a few people that's had trouble. And they tell me that you are a sick man. You are an alcoholic. You can be helped. If, there's always a catch, if you won't help." And he said, "Do you?" I says, "You doggone took me, I do. I always wanted help. But how badly and honestly did I want this help?" And he says, "Would you go to an institution they have in this town?" And he didn't know too much about the institution. It was a mental institution. But they were taking alcoholics at this time. And he says, "I will take you if you mean business." And I said, "I'll go." And he went back to school for a day, and I'm trying to get over this drunk. I hadn't had a drink in probably 24 to 36 hours. And he came by to take me to the hospital. And I remember shaking all the way there. And he went in to see the two doctors. And I sat out there shaking, wanting a drink of liquor, of course. And yet, I didn't want to take it, but yet I thought I needed it. When he came out, they called me in and gave me the seventh degree, I guess you would call it. And you know, I told these doctors pretty well the truth for the first time. You know, I used to go to psychiatrists. My wife used to send me. And I used to go to Columbia to see a psychiatrist. And he'd ask me a lot of questions, and I'd tell him a lot of lies. And then he'd say, "Do you drink much?" And I said, "No, I don't drink much." He says, "You're drinking now." I says, "I know it." He says, "Why are you drinking?" I says, "I'm nervous." He says, "Well, if you just drink for that reason, it's not too bad." And I'd go back home and tell my wife, "The psychiatrist says that I should have a little drink every now and then to help my nerves." It's a dickens of a way to go to a doctor. But they knew. They knew, and I knew they knew because he told them about me. When I got through, he says, "Berger, you are an alcoholic." And he turned around to the other doctor and he says, "He's an alcoholic, isn't he?" The other doctor says, "He sure is." And I said, "That's the third time I've been called an alcoholic. And 3 days. Pretty good. It must be one of those things, or whatever they are." And then he said to me, "I want you to stay about 10 days. That was ridiculous, but I stayed. You know why I stayed? I didn't have anywhere to go. That's the reason. I didn't have anywhere to go. I was backed up against a brick wall. The third day, I'm guessing, the third day I think I was there, a doctor came to see me. And he sat down with me. And he says, "Berger, I'm an alcoholic. I said, oh, you can't be. He says, I am an alcoholic. Not only an alcoholic, but also addiction has also been a problem of mine. I have been in AA a year and a half, a day at the time. I don't have a license to practice medicine in South Carolina, but I can under this other doctor. I'm a doctor, a medical doctor, I'm a psychiatrist. I lived in West Virginia. I had a wonderful practice, a fine wife, and two fine children. My brother came into AA 5 years ago, and he hasn't had a drink since. He came to see me and told me about AA, and I told him to leave me alone. So many of us do that, don't we? I'm a scientist. How can you tell me how to stay sober? And I ran him away. And then, as time went on, I lost my license. I lost my practice. I lost my wife. I lost my two beautiful daughters. I lost my self-respect. And this is what it'll do if you drink long enough and strong enough. I want you to try AA. I don't care what religion you are, if you have none at all. And this is true in most men and women that come into AA, or has been true in most cases that I've witnessed in the past. He says, I stay sober one day at a time. This I have learned in AA and by AAs. I wake up in the morning, I ask God for help. And I do it as honestly as I know how. And I stay sober. And at night, I thank God as I understand Him. And it gives me a feeling of relief. You run it the way you want to. You will find it to help you. One other thing. And this I have said many years since I heard it from him. And I say it everywhere I go. What have you got to lose? Nothing. What have you got to gain? Everything. Life itself. Isn't it so true? I fell in love with this man's story more than I did him. I thought about the Horatio Alger books I read as a little boy. This is a fairy tale, but I'm going to join up with him. And I bought the big book, and I bought this, and he says, I want to take you to a meeting tomorrow night in Augusta, Georgia. They hadn't started over there long, but I want you to go. And I said, Doc, I'll do anything. He says, that's wonderful. And I'll remember the next night, five of us started out to Augusta. This was in Aiken, South Carolina. This hospital was only about, 18 miles away, I'm guessing. We drove up. There I was, riding to Augusta to an AA meeting. Has this happened to you? I know it's happened to a lot of you. I was so in love with this thing yesterday. I heard this man's success story. And here I am going to an AA meeting and the perspiration running off. Frightened, scared, ashamed. I think this would answer it. What was I getting into? Are you so weak that you must belong to a group or a clan or whatever it is called AA? And the five of us started into this church, Sunday school class, behind the Catholic church there in Forest Hills, meet out there now, right close. And I walked in, shaken, ashamed, and frightened. This can happen to any of us. And a fellow met me at the door, and I'm glad he did. And he said, my name is Bill. And I said, my name is Manuel Berger, and walked in. But he stopped me. And he said, are you any relation to Al Berger? I says, I don't know him. And I kept on going, and I sat down. Must have been 10, 11 people there, and a man was leading the meeting and reading or trying to explain the 12 steps of AA, and I didn't even listen. After the meeting was over, I went up to him, and I said, Bill, did you say Al Berger? And he says, that's right. I says, that's my brother. He says, hell, and you it all the time. But that's all right. You ain't going to stay sober. This hurt. But he didn't stop there. He said, do you want sobriety more than you want anything else? You drive your own car. Do you want to drive it on the right of the road and sensibly and honestly and sincerely? You're going to make this program, Berger. But if you come in your line, you're not going to stay sober. You'll go in the ditch. I remember these words. And you know, I felt better going home, or going back to the hospital that night. I told the truth again. And you know, I hadn't been telling it too often, and I want to tell you now, I may be a little skeptical of it sometimes now, but I'm trying, and you can't beat that, can you? I'm guessing we all try. That's the reason. That's the only thing we can do. I went home about a week later, 10 days later, and I bought the big book, and I walked into the house, and I handed it to my wife, and I says, honey, look what I have done. I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought she was going to run up to me and grab me around the neck and kiss me and tell me what a great fellow I was. She says, well, hell, you the drunk, you ought to read it. And walked off. Didn't like it. Didn't like it a bit. And I remember there the first nights I was still shaking, but the book was close by. You know, I don't think the book is passed around enough now. I don't think it's read enough either. I would like to see more people read this big book than are reading it. Give a few away. Call it lending if you want it, because they ain't going to bring it back. I've tried it 50 times. They just don't return books, that's all, especially AA books. And a lot of them don't even know where they put them, because they throw them under the bed or something when they get them. I know that. But I opened this book up at random, any page, and I read, and it seemed to have given me peace and contentment. And I went to sleep. And this is what I began to practice, what the doctor said. Ask for help in the morning, perhaps only with faith of a child. But this is good. Read the book a little bit at night before going to bed, and thanking the power that I call then, higher than I was, and that was pretty hard for me to do at that time. And I began to stay sober. They started meetings in Aiken, and I was about 80 miles, and I began riding on Wednesday or Thursday nights to these meetings. Charleston had AA, and I started going to Charleston. Columbia had AA, and I began going to Columbia, and I heard Dr. Sam, who lived up here in Rome. Rome is right, isn't it? And I met this man, and I thought he was wonderful. And people said to me at the meetings in Aiken, Berger, you've got something. You've got to give it away. Find another drunk. And I began looking for another drunk. But I didn't know too many in this town. I hadn't been there long. And when you're not drinking, you just don't mess around with other drunks. So I advertised. I was looking for a drunk. And the telephone rang one day, and this fellow said, Berger, I got you a real drunk. I said, thank God. I just hold him till I get there. And I immediately went out, and he was a corker. And I drove this old boy around for about 2 hours and talked. Hey, I'd been sober, look, 3 months. And I knew all about it. If you don't believe me, all you have to do then is ask me. And then when I got through, he says, let's tell my wife about it. And I went to the house, and I talked to her for about an hour. This is my first man in AA. And she looked at me, I'll never forget this, and she said, Berger, this program is going to help a lot of people, but not him. She just had a lot of faith in him, that's all. And then I remember the wisdom, the words of wisdom of the good doctor, and he said, and I told her, what have you got to lose? Nothing. What have you got to gain? Everything. She said, you're right, buddy. She was a school teacher then. She tried to agree. She wasn't too happy, and you can understand this man. I left, and I told her, if you need me, let me know. I'm ready and available at any time. And I went home, and the next day she called me and says, you told me to call you? And I said, yes, sir. She says, he's drunk. He's got a knife. He's got a gun. He's ready to kill. I says, yes, sir. She said, you coming? I says, I don't know. I was scared. But, you know, we alcoholics are pretty brilliant. The liquor store was back there, and I bought him a bottle of booze, and I walked right to him, guns and knives and all. They don't shoot you when you're bringing them booze, do they? And I got him good and drunk, and then I figured the... I told you I was a philosopher and a psychologist. I figured it out. Take him where you were. If it's good for you, it's good for him. And that's what I did. I threw him in the car after he passed out, and I carried him to Aiken to the hospital. He didn't know he was going. His wife didn't either. They threw him in the bullpen. I was through with him. I went on back home, called his wife up and told her what I'd done. She didn't know too much about it. She says, I guess it's all right. About 2 days later, his wife called me and says, Berg, I said, yes'm. He says, Elma called. I said, yes'm. He said he wanted me to come for him, or you. If he didn't, he's going to kill us both. I went for him. My first. You know, I brought him home, and he says, Berg, I want to try AA. And I felt big. This man is going to make it like me. I put myself up first, of course. And I went to the mayor of town. He gave a city hall. And then I went to a nearby town. And I got a medical doctor I heard was having some trouble. And I got him to the first meeting. And I'll never forget this first meeting in Walterboro as long as I live. It was in the store. I opened the meeting with a few moments of silent meditation. And about that time, the little doctor says, Berger, what time is it? And I told him. He says, by golly, wait a minute. It's time for Amos and Andy. Let's dispense with the meeting for now, and after Amos and Andy, we will resume the meeting. And I got madder than the devil, but I didn't want to get too mad. I figured we didn't have but three members, and how can you lose one? So we had the meeting. There was AA. I advertised on the radio and in the newspaper. You know, people around there thought I was pretty brilliant. I used to copy some chapters out of the big book and put it in the newspaper. Nobody in New York knew it. And got good advertisement. No names. And then did the same thing over radio. And we began having little crowds, and things looked pretty good. And what was the greatest thing of all? There Elmer was staying sober. And he was the worst, they said. People in this town used to walk up to me and pat me on the back. Then they started pinning medals on me, and man, I used to shine up these invisible medals. And I said, boy, I'm doing a terrific job. I've got this boy sober. I did it. Remember I told you about asking for help in the morning and thanking at night? I didn't do that anymore. I didn't need God. I was it. How I stayed sober as long as I did, I'll never know. And I remember I'd been sober about 8 months. Elmer had been sober about 4 or 5. I don't remember. I said to Elma and Elma's wife one night, let's go into Atlanta and carry the message of AA. Let's go to Rome and see Dr. Sam and tell him what we're doing in South Carolina. And his wife says, I think it's a good idea. Told my wife about it. I think she knew better. She says, go anywhere you want to. And I remember his wife saying, take my Lincoln. And Elma turned to me and says, that's the first time it ever happened. He'd been in the lumber business and he made some money. And on his last drunk, he bought his wife a Lincoln. Keep the noise down. And he says, this is great. She's never offered me anything like this. And I remember we started out for Atlanta, Georgia. We got down about 5 miles or 6 miles down the road. I turned to Elma and I says, Elma, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could take a drink? And he said, hell, you can. He says, you've been sober 8 months. I can take one, too. I've been sober about 4 or 5 months. But remember, we can only take one or two. And I said, that's right. That's what I wanted him to say. The next town we got to, he bought 2 fists and I bought 2 fists. And we got to Augusta. There was 2 drunk boys. And the next morning, we couldn't go back this way. So he got us a chauffeur and drove to Atlanta. Couldn't get in a hotel here for the devil. They must have spotted us. We did get into Briarcliff. And my wife had a couple of uncles living in the Briarcliff. So we went on the freight elevator. I remember that. And they had one of these efficiency apartments down at the Briarcliff. And you know, it's some stores across the street over there. And Elma passed out. So I went over to one of these grocery stores, and I bought about $50 worth of groceries. This other drunk, I was going to cook for Elma. I bought flowers and put them on the table. I did things like this. I was going to be great to him. And when he came to, I passed out. And he called his wife down in Walterboro, South Carolina, and said, honey, I'm drunk. Now, he didn't tell me this, but the boy that didn't drink told me this, the chauffeur. He says he called his wife and told her that he was drunk. Well, you don't have to do that. They can smell your father in New York over the telephone. And he said, be sure and call that great A. Burger's wife up and tell her he's drunk too. And when I heard this, my medals had vanished, and that was bad. The chip that I carried in my pocket, I did for maybe 3 months, and then I put it on my shoulder. Doesn't work. Doesn't work. Somebody knocks it off sooner or later. Mine was knocked off. I came back home. Gee, I'm talking too long. I came back home, and things weren't the same. It wasn't about 2 weeks later, this wonderful brother-in-law and his wife came down. They had a little conference. They told me to get out, and I got out and left. But first, I bought a few bottles, and then I called up everybody I knew to tell these people how they had mistreated me. And this was wrong. They're taking my children away from me. And I left. I had some people to ask me this first or second week, why did you let them run you out of your own house? And I didn't know the answer. I know it now. I've been knowing it for a long time. How can you fight back when you haven't got anything to fight back with? How can you shoot a gun when it's empty and no ammunition is in it? Can't do it. I left because I knew that I was wrong. As time went on, I started begging my wife to take me back. I ended back in the hospital that moved from Aiken to Orangeburg, I remember. I remember AA is a few of them in that area. Didn't have too many of them came to see me and wanted to know what they could do for me. I lived only 12 miles away, and my daddy told me to come home. My sister that I'd mistreated and her husband up in Greenwood says, come up there and live. And I began to write letters to my wife to tell her, I would never do it again. Take me back. Don't take my children away from me. You know, isn't it a funny thing? These kind of fathers, these kind of mothers, they have love for their children. But how can others know? They'll never know. But I know that they do have it. I went to AA. People said, pray. And I prayed. Guess what I prayed for? Prayed for my wife back. Prayed for my children back. I prayed for this back. I prayed for that back. Guess what I got? Nothing. And then I said, God is not for me. I thought of suicide. I heard a lot of people tell you about suicide. And something tapped them. Nothing tapped me. The reason I didn't do it, I was yelling, scared to die. That's the reason I didn't do it. I know why. I know why. But I continued to go to AA. How long can you last with this kind of way in thinking? I was in Atlanta, Georgia, in August of this year. Of that year was 1948. And I happened to wake up, and I was traveling in one of the hotels downtown, Grady. And I said, by golly, it's a convention, Southeastern Convention, down in Jacksonville, Florida. I thought it was also September that year. And I got in the car and drove home that night. The convention started the next day. And I said to myself, why are you going? I didn't know. And it seemed there was an urge. And I got in my car and drove into Jacksonville the next day. I got in there that afternoon. I didn't check into the hotel where they were having the convention. I went to another one because I might get drunk, and I didn't want to be around a bunch of AAs. And I remember that night on the next block below the George Washington Hotel, I walked. And it's a lot of bars on both sides. And I wanted to go in there and drink, and so I could sit down and have people to have sympathy for me and have sympathy for myself and tell others my troubles and how I'd been misunderstood, would we say? But I didn't take a drink, thank God, and I walked through that Mayflower Hotel, and there's a bar as you go to the elevator. And I wanted to go there, too, and I went in my room. I said I lost all faith in God, and I did, but I still mentioned things about prayer, if you want to call it prayer at night. I wanted something, and I didn't seem to ask the right thing or would let myself go. I went to the meeting the next day, and I remember Father Fowle, Bill was there, and Sam was there, quite a lot of others. And I remember the Father saying, God always answers prayers. And I said, there he goes again. And I remember the AAs told me, Berger, keep an open mind. And I did. I had one so doggone open it'd get out before it got in. We got those kind of minds running around now. But he finished it. And he said that God always answers prayers. But sometimes, and many times, the answer is no. And I went back to my room that Friday, I think it's Friday or Saturday, I don't remember. And I said, Berger, maybe this is you. Maybe this is you. And I went out to the picnic, I remember, at the air base that Saturday afternoon. And I knew just a few people. I sat in these meetings, lonely. Oh, how lonely we can be when we practice our disease. And one of the boys from Columbia rode back to Columbia with me the next day. And I began hanging around Columbia. And I kept trying, and of course I ran her into Reno, Nevada, and that was out then. I knew it, and the children at the grandmother's. And I tried something else. You see, you remember me telling you that I decided many years ago that I couldn't drink, and I was whipped, but I didn't do anything about it. Then I began to take a little inventory. It wasn't overnight. When the decision was not only there because I couldn't drink, but the decision to be made, and successful decision to make, is to accept. I think this is true with any man or woman that has success in AA. I finally accepted AA for what it was. I try. I believe when any of you and I accept this program, you and I will be successful. When you and I believe this, turn our will and our life over to the care of a God as we understand Him, and this I believe today, we're going to be successful. I believe when we try to make amends as best as possible, this too will help us be successful. I believe on down the steps even, and you know, when you go to AA meetings and you've been in AA a little while, so your wife says to you, honey, why don't you go into the meeting tonight and you're watching television? Says, I don't think so. John Jones is going to talk tonight. Hell, I know his story better than he does. I can even get up and give it. Interviews for me to go tonight. This is trouble. But when we take a daily inventory of ourselves, we see ourselves for what we are each day. I married a girl in AA. I call her a girl yet. She likes that. Margaret knows her. And Clarence knows her. We'll be celebrating our 17th year this November. Time marches on. I believe that any man that tries to, a woman that tries to work the first 12 steps of this program will have a spiritual awakening. I believe also that the man that has a spiritual awakening will try to help anyone else they can. As we say in AA now from General Service, we are responsible and should be. And then the hardest thing for me to do of all is to try to live this life in all my daily affairs. Yes, I lost a wife. I lost myself. I lost two children. I'm spending the night tonight with my youngest son, who's finishing dental school this year, and his cute little wife. This is another blessing of AA. My oldest son finished Michigan this past year, master's degree, and married recently. This is another blessing of AA. My ex-mother-in-law said to me a few years ago when she put her arms around me and said, son, call me mother. What is this? What is this but a blessing? What is AA to you? What is AA to me? A new way of life. Where you and I can have respect for each other. Where we can call this thing that we've heard so much about over the years, brotherly love. We can have it here. Not 100%, maybe not 80%. But we can have it here by leaps and bounds. For all these attributes of AA that you and I have found, I hope and pray I can say, thank you, dear God. Thank you, and God bless you.